Medical examiner and forensic investigators have done an amazing job. The first of these women has been identified, and her family has been contacted. Thanks to the hard work of a lot of people, this young woman can finally be laid to rest. Before she says the woman's name, a picture appears on the screen. I know her. Jessica. The cashier at the Easy Go where I get my coffee. She left not long ago. The guy who took her place said she was going to school in another state. I am shocked Millicent knew who she was. Millicent does not buy coffee or anything else at the Easy Go. She must have been following me for a lot longer than I realized. Maybe Millicent has always kept track of what I do and who I speak to. This idea makes my heart beat too fast. I put down the coffee. On TV, a split screen has Jessica on one side and Claire on the other. The detective is still talking, explaining that the other women have not been identified. Now I know what Millicent has done. She has killed women I know who can be connected to me. Maybe this was part of her setup. Or maybe she thinks I was sleeping with all of them. Perhaps she has gone scorched earth, destroying everyone who could be a threat. My mind spins with who the other two might be, not any of my clients. None have disappeared recently, and if they did, I would know. Wealthy people don't just vanish without someone looking for them. I run through all the women I know, particularly young women who fit Owen's profile. A number of them work at the club as bartenders, waitresses, retail sales clerks. I know all of them by sight and have said hello to most. Some have been there longer than others. Most are still there. They aren't dead in a church basement. Except one. Beth. Perky Beth from Alabama, a waitress at the club. We never had an affair. She was just a nice young woman, and sometimes we talked while I ate at the clubhouse. That was it. Not long ago, she left because of a family emergency back in Mobile. The manager of the restaurant told me that. No one questioned this. No one suspected anything had happened to her. No one showed up looking for her. If more time had passed, maybe her family would have. I get up and start pacing, first around the theater room and then throughout the whole house, upstairs, downstairs, into all the rooms and around in a circle. One more. Millicent killed a third woman. No one else has disappeared, not that I know of, so I wonder if it might be Petra. With Annabelle and the bartenders around to recognize Tobias, why not get rid of her? A ringing phone breaks through my panic. The only one who has my new number is Andy. It's you, he says. He does not mention the police sketch and does not have to. I nod at the phone as if he can see me. This is what I was telling you, I say. She's setting me up.
Yeah, I got that part. But you failed to convey the magnitude of her anger.
I said you didn't want to know. I told you.
How is she even doing this?
Again, I want to tell him, but I can't. I also do not have a good answer. If I knew, I would tell the police. He sighs. Right before he hangs up, he says,
God damn it.
And he still has Millicent's tablet. All day I watch the news, scour my laptop, and look up my kids on the internet. My search comes up with nothing new. Just some old articles in the local paper from Jenna's soccer team or Rory in a golf tournament. I look at the pictures I took from the house. They feel like they are from 100 years ago, back when I had a life that now feels like a dream. Nighttime. I am out by the pool, pacing around it. If Kokona had any neighbors, they would think I must be a madman, which I may be, but no one is close enough. Since no one is, I jump in the pool, clothes and all, and stay underwater until I can't. The air feels like a shock when I break the surface. It both wakes me up and calms me down. I climb out and lie down on the patio, staring up at the sky, trying not to wonder how much worse it can get. My life has just blown up, and I should feel angry. I think the anger is there, bubbling under the surface, all mixed in with the sadness and heartbreak, the guilt and shame and horror. It will all come, and it will all overwhelm me, but not yet. Not until I figure out how to get myself out of this mess and get my kids. I fall asleep thinking of them. Just us, not Millicent. The sun and the birds wake me up. It's so peaceful here at Kokona's, so easy to pretend the rest of the world doesn't exist. I understand why she rarely leaves the Oaks. Why would anyone willingly leave this for reality? I would not, if I didn't have to. Eventually, I do go back inside and turn on the TV. Me. I am on that wall, staring back at myself. My picture fills the screen, and my name appears at the bottom, along with a banner, Person of Interest. Even though I am expecting it, I still fall to my knees. So fast. My whole life has fallen apart in less than a week. If it were not happening to me, I would not believe this is possible. Josh's voice makes me look up. He is talking, always talking, but today he is not a reporter. Because we met at the first street bar and grill, he is the subject of the interview, the star. Most of what he says is a lie, and an abbreviated one at that. I approached him, I asked him about the case, I begged him to give me the names of his sources. He skips the part about getting drunk, calling Claire Wellington a bitch, complaining about the information he had and shared but could not say on the air. I understand the police are calling this man a person of interest, and maybe that's all he is. I can only tell you what I felt. You know that feeling you get when something is just wrong? Like that little alarm goes off in your head telling you to get away? That's how this guy made me feel. His remark is creepy enough to make me sound guilty, even though Josh had been in no condition to feel anything when I met him. I want to put the battery back in my real phone to see if the kids texted me, if they're worried, if they believe what is being said about me, or to see how many times the police have called. Instead, I am alone, trapped in Kokona's beautiful house without anyone to talk to. Until the phone rings. Andy. I pick up but don't say a word. He is already talking.
Those murders really upset Trista. I'm almost glad she can't see how many there are. If Trista were still alive, she would know Owen didn't kill these women, and she would have no reason to kill herself. I do not mention this.
I remember, I say. She talked about it at the club.
But you didn't do it.
I did not kill those women.
True, I only killed Holly, and no one found her. If I find out different,
call the police, I say. Turn me in.
I was going to say I'll kill you myself.
I take a deep breath. Deal.
I got into this tablet. Can you tell me where you are?
For your own good, you
don't want to know, he says. I got it.
We meet in another parking lot, not the one outside Golden Walk. My disguise is a baseball cap and sunglasses, and I have not shaved for 2 days. It isn't much, but no one is looking for me inside Kokona's SUV. I drive out the back gate of Hidden Oaks to avoid the guards. It is after dark because I will not go out during the day. I also won't let Andy see the car or the license plate, so it's parked 2 blocks away and I walk down to the lot. He is standing outside his truck with Millicent's tablet in his hand. No other cars are around, no lights on. The lot belongs to a boarded up car parts store. Andy is standing a bit straighter than he was the last time I saw him. His chin is up.
Whole damn county is looking for you, he says.
Yeah, I got that. Andy turns around and sets the tablet on the hood, keeping it propped up with his hand. If you tell me you failed, I'll stop believing you're a genius, I say.
I never fail. but I don't know if any of this is helpful.
He swipes the screen, which lights up with a keypad. New code, 6374.
First, the bad news. She must have known you took this because she wiped out everything in the cloud.
Of course she did.
Not to worry, there's some good news. She did have some information stored on the hard drive. She couldn't get to that.
He shows me a few pictures, a couple of the kids, a few of open houses, and a snapshot of a grocery list. I shake my head. It's all too mundane to be useful.
She liked games, Andy says.
He opens a few Match 3 games and crossword puzzles. Any hope I have blows away like a dead leaf. Of course there is nothing on the tablet. Millicent would never be so stupid.
Also found a few recipes,
he says, bringing up some PDF files.
Stuffed mushrooms, huh? The spinach hummus dip sounds good.
I sigh. You're an asshole.
Hey, it's your wife, he says. Last but not least, her internet searches and the sites she visited. She cleared the history, but I recovered most of it for what it's worth.
Not much. More recipes, medical websites about sprained wrists and upset stomachs, the school's online calendar, and a bunch of real estate websites.
No smoking gun, I say.
Doesn't look like it. I sigh.
Not your fault.
Thanks for trying.
You owe me forever, you know, he says.
If I don't go to jail for life. He gives me a hug before driving away in his old truck. I am alone again, in no hurry to get back to Kokona's. Even a big house can feel suffocating. Instead, I go back to the tablet, looking through all those real estate websites she visited. No one is perfect, I tell myself. Not even Millicent. Somehow, somewhere, she made a mistake. My eyes are almost bleeding when I find it.
66. The website Millicent visited the most is a property database. She went to the site every day researching sales records and real estate transfers, all of which were public information. Her browser recorded the addresses she researched. One of them is a commercial building at 1121 Brownfield Avenue. 6 months ago, a man named Donald J. Kendrick sold the building for $162,000. The building has been around for more than 20 years and has had one long-time tenant, Joe's Deli. Donald sold the building to an LLC owned by another LLC and then a third. Ultimately, the building is now owned by RJ Enterprises, LLC. Rory. Jenna. This is Millicent being clever, because she would not see it as a mistake. Our children are never a mistake. This was on purpose. I think back to 6 months ago, realizing that it was right after she sold three houses in a row. Plenty of cash for her to use. Denise was never a client of Millicent's. She is a tenant. A tenant who just happened to know Owen's sister. Knowing Millicent, she spent hours researching Owen's history, his family, where they lived and went to school. She hunted until she discovered that Owen was actually dead, and then she found someone who could prove it, like Owen's sister. She just needed to get her back in the country. Who better than an old friend, especially an old friend with a demanding landlord, someone who contacted Jennifer Riley and begged her to speak up about Owen's death. Millicent. All Millicent. And all within the past 6 months. Now I understand her reaction about the Jane Doe victims in the news. Millicent was convinced they were lying. She'd insisted that the real Owen had not returned. She already knew he was dead. Her dedication to ruining me would be admirable if it weren't so sick. Yet I still have no proof. Just an LLC and a commercial building, which even a bad lawyer would argue was an investment, not a plot to frame someone for murder. I drive back into Hidden Oaks through the back gate, using Kokona's remote to open it. Once inside, I have an urge to drive past my house, The sun is coming up, and I wonder if the kids are asleep. If they can sleep. If we lived anywhere else, they would be surrounded by reporters. Not here. The public does not have access. But I don't drive by. That would be stupid. Instead, I go back to Kokona's and turn on her giant screen. Me. It is all about me. Now that I have been identified, everyone has something to say about me, and they all say it on camera. Former clients, co-workers, acquaintances, all weigh in on the fact that I am a person of interest, a missing person of interest. Nice guy, a little too smooth maybe, but what do you expect from a tennis coach? My daughter took lessons from him, and now I'm just glad she's alive. Used to see him at the club, always hustling for clients. My wife and I have known them for years. Never would have guessed. Never. Right here in Hidden Oaks? This is unbelievable. Really. Terrifying. Josh is now being interviewed by other reporters because his talking to me makes him part of the story. My boss says I was the best tennis pro he has ever employed, and it's too bad I'm a sicko. And Millicent. She does not appear on camera, nor do they show a picture of her, but my wife releases a statement. My children and I ask that you respect our privacy during this unimaginably difficult time. I am cooperating fully with the police and have nothing further at this time. Short, sweet, and written by Millicent. Probably dictated by a lawyer, perhaps one of her clients. Someone who used to be my friend. Now I just have Andy. Although if he knew the truth, he would kill me. I think of Kokona, wonder if she is my friend, if she would believe me if she were here. We've known each other for at least 5 years, and we have relaxed into an easy banter at our lessons. Even when she misses a lesson, she still pays, and when she has a party, she always invites us. Does this make her a friend? I don't know anymore. I am not used to being this alone. For 17 years, Millicent has been with me, and for most of that time, so were the kids. I've had a family to worry about me. After the first few years back in Hidden Oaks, my old friends started to get married, move away, start their own families. It didn't seem to matter that they weren't around. I was busy enough without them. Now I see my mistake. Focusing only on my family has left me isolated and alone. Except for one old friend who can never know the truth. My pity party is broken up by Claire Wellington, who I bet hates parties. She's that one who checks her watch, sips a glass of water, and waits for an escape. I have no idea if this is correct, but I believe it anyway. She holds another news conference at 5 o'clock, just in time for the evening news. Today her suit is an ugly color of gray, like flannel, though it isn't because this is Florida and that would be ridiculous. Her hair is dull and so is her skin. Claire is not getting much sleep and should probably stop working so much.
As everyone knows, we have a team of people working to identify the women found in the church basement. 23-year-old Jessica Sharp was the first to be identified. Now we have identified the other two.
She takes a deep breath, and so do I. Easels are set up on either side of her. Both pictures are covered, and a uniformed policeman reveals the first. I am right. It's Beth. She is wearing no makeup in the picture, and her hair is pulled back into a ponytail. This makes her look about 12.
Beth Randall was 24. Originally from Alabama, and she was most recently employed as a waitress at the Hidden Oaks Country Club. Not long ago, her parents received a letter they thought was from her. Whoever wrote it claimed Beth was moving up to Montana to work on a farm.
Millicent. I would know her sense of humor anywhere. The only thing she hated more than fishing boats was farms.
At the same time, her employer received a letter saying that she had a family emergency and was returning home to Alabama to help. Neither knew their letter was a fake.
Claire pauses for a moment as the cameras zoom in on the photo of Beth. She then turns to the other easel. I still think it must be Petra. I cannot think of anyone else who has disappeared or moved away. And I haven't checked on Petra in a long time. If I could have left the house, I might have. The policeman unveils the photo. This time I am wrong. It is not Petra. Crystal. The woman who used to work for us. The one who kissed me. I'd never even thought of her. Now that I think about it, I should have. But I haven't seen Crystal in more than a year. We haven't been in contact at all since she stopped working for us. Did Millicent know about the kiss? Is that why she killed Crystal? Or was she just collateral damage, part of Millicent's bigger plan? I may never know. Of all the questions I would ask Millicent, those would not be in the top 10. But my guess is that Crystal told Millicent. She was tortured into it. I do not want to think about that. The press conference is still on, and Claire introduces a man whose name I recognize from a documentary about Owen. He is a rather famous profiler, now retired, who is now an independent consultant and has written several true crime books. This man, this tall, thin, decrepit-looking man, steps up to the podium and says he has never encountered a killer like me.
He kills women, he knows, in a peripheral way, such as this cashier. And he also has created a separate persona, a deaf man named Tobias, that he uses to find more victims. The variety of methods used may be what has kept him from being discovered for so long.
Or maybe it's all a lie. But no one says that. Piece by piece, my life is destroyed like it was never real at all. It was just a line of dominoes set up by Millicent. The faster they fall, the less likely it seems I can get myself out of this. And still, I watch. I watch until my eyes blur and my head feels like it's crumbling into my neck. Definitive proof. This is what I need. Something like DNA evidence on a murder weapon or video of Millicent killing one of these women. I just don't have it. The phone wakes me up. In the middle of watching my personal apocalypse, I dozed off. Kokona's theater seats are just too comfortable. I pick up my phone and hear Andy's voice. Still breathing? Barely. I can't believe they haven't caught you. You underestimate my intelligence. On TV, they are showing a picture of me at my high school prom. More like dumb luck, he says. On top of everything else, there is the guilt. Andy believes in me because he doesn't know the half of it. Another profiler is on TV. He has a deep, twangy accent that makes me want to turn the channel, but I do not.
The level of torture can be directly correlated to the level of anger the killer has for the victim. For example, the burns on Naomi indicate that the killer was furious with her for some reason. It's impossible to know if the rage came from something she did or someone she reminded him of. Likely, we won't know that until he is caught.
Now I turn the channel, and I see a ghost. My ghost. Petra. 67. She is not only alive, she looks different. Not as much makeup and less flash. More upscale, as if she has spent the past couple of days getting a makeover. Her blue eyes are sharp and focused, and her previously unremarkable hair is shiny and stylish. I remember her apartment, her bed, the cat named Lionel. She likes lime green and French vanilla ice cream, and she couldn't believe I like ham on my pizza. I don't. I also remember the sound of Petra's voice when she asked if I was really deaf. The same voice she has now on TV. Suspicious. Accusatory. A tiny bit hurt. I met Tobias in a bar. When the reporter asks why she waited days to come forward, Petra hesitates before answering.
Because I slept with him.
You slept with him? She nods, hangs her head in shame. For having sex or for choosing me, I don't know which one, maybe both. At first, the media portrayed me as just a sick, twisted, psychopathic serial killer. Now I am a sick, twisted, psychopathic serial killer who cheats on his wife. As if people needed another reason to hate me. If they knew where I was, they would be lined up with pitchforks. But they don't know, so I am still able to sit here, watch TV, eat junk food, and wait until they either find me or Kokona returns home, whichever comes first. Petra goes from being nowhere to everywhere. She lies about some things, tells the truth about others. With each interview, the story becomes a little more detailed, and my depression digs in a little deeper. I still have moments when I think I can do something, so for hours I go through that stupid tablet like something new will appear. Perhaps a video of Millicent in that basement, or a list of the women to kill. When I'm not doing something useless, I am useless. A lump of self-hate and pity, wondering why I ever got married in the first place, wishing I had never seen Millicent, much less sat next to her on that airplane. I wouldn't have turned into who I am now without her. And when I'm not sinking into the quicksand of depression, I stare at the TV. I pretend all of this is someone else's problem. I wonder how much my kids hate me, and what Dr. Beige is saying about me. I bet he is telling Jenna I am the source of all her problems. It was never Millicent, never Owen, always me, because it couldn't be her. Andy calls again.
I saw your wife, he says.
You what?
Millicent. I went over to your house and saw her, he says.
Why?
Look, I'm trying to help you out here. It's not like I want to be in the same room with that woman, he says. So I called her. Millicent and I have a lot in common. We've both lost our spouses.
Except I'm not dead. Were the kids there?
Yes, saw them both. They're fine. Maybe a little stir crazy because they're staying in the house, the media and all.
Did they say anything about me? A pause.
No.
This is probably good news, but it still hurts.
Listen, whatever you're going to do, you better do it fast, Andy says. Millicent said she wants to take the kids and get out of here for a while.
This would be reasonable for a wife who discovered her husband is a serial killer. It would also be reasonable for a serial killer who'd framed her husband. She didn't say where, did she?
No.
Didn't think so.
One more thing, he says.
What's that?
If I hadn't talked to you before all this happened, I don't know if I'd believe you. Not after seeing Millicent like that.
Like what?
Like she's devastated.
The last part is what worries me. No one is going to believe a word I say. Not without proof. As the hours pass, I sink further into Kokona's chair. The images on the TV float past my eyes. Lindsay, Naomi, me, Petra, Josh. He is talking, always talking, and he repeats everything. Autopsy, strangled, tortured. He must have said that last one a million times. At 1,000,001, I sit up straight. I am up. Racing around Kokona's house, throwing aside my clothes and garbage until I find it. Millicent's tablet. She had looked at medical websites for information about the kids' ailments, but maybe there was more. Maybe I had missed it. If I was going to torture someone but not kill them, I would have to research it, and I would start by looking up various injuries on medical websites. A long shot. A very, very long shot. As stupid as I feel for thinking that this kind of evidence might be on the tablet, what keeps me going is imagining how stupid I would feel if I didn't look, and it was right there all along. I find the tablet in Kokona's dining room on a table large enough to seat 16. It seems like a perfect place to sit down and go through the tablet again. I check each site, looking for something about torture and strangulation. I look for hot water burns and oil burns and internal bleeding and cuts on eyelids. I even look for cigarette burns, which is absurd because Millicent refuses to be near cigarettes. And I find nothing. She looked at how long it takes for a sprained wrist to heal. She also searched for a variety of information about upset stomachs, what caused them, and what to do about them. That was it. Nothing about torture, nothing helpful. I should have known better. I shove the tablet away and it skids. My immediate reaction is to check and see if I scratched Kokona's dining room table, as if it matters, but I do it anyway. I stand up and look straight down at it, running my finger across the wood, when something on the tablet screen catches my eye. It is still on the page about upset stomachs. On the right-hand side, there is a list of possible causes. One of them is purple instead of blue, because the link has been clicked. Eye drops. 68. Tetrahydrozoline is the active ingredient in eye drops that gets rid of red eyes. Swallowing a large amount can cause serious problems. The drops lower blood pressure and can put someone into a coma or kill them. But swallowing a small amount causes an upset stomach and vomiting. No fever. The eye drops belong to Millicent. She has been giving them to Jenna. No. Impossible. The thought makes me physically ill. Jenna is our child, our daughter. She is not Lindsay or Naomi. She is not someone to torture. Or maybe she is. Maybe Jenna is no different. Not to Millicent. My daughter does not have a recurring stomach problem. She has a mother who is poisoning her. I want to kill Millicent. I want to go to my house, kill my wife, and be done with it. I am that angry. This feeling is different. Before, I never actually thought, I want to kill a woman, or even, I want to kill this particular woman. My desire wasn't that clear, that succinct. It was about Millicent, about the two of us, and what I wanted out of it was more complex. Now it is simple. I want my wife to die. I head for the front door without a hat or a disguise or a weapon of any kind. I am angry and disgusted, and I do not care if I have a plan. My hand is on the doorknob when I realize how stupid I am, how stupid I always am. I could probably get across Hidden Oaks without being spotted. Most think I'm on the run, not hiding in my own neighborhood. And once I did get all the way to my house, I could get inside because I have a key. That's assuming it's not under surveillance. On the other side, my wife, who I now know is a monster. Just like the real Owen. Also, my kids, they are in the house, and both believe it is me, not her. I am the monster. And now all I can see is their reaction when I kill their mother. I do not open the door, and I do not just need a plan. I need evidence, because on TV, evidence of me is everywhere. My DNA. Though it should not be a surprise, Millicent still astonishes me. I have been saying that since I met her. She managed to get my DNA all over the Bread of Life Christian Church. My sweat is found on the door handle out front, on the lock, down to the basement, even on the stair railing. It is like she had a vial of my sweat and dabbed it everywhere. A spot of my blood is found on the shelves against the wall, more sweat on the handcuffs, blood on the chains and dirt. She makes it look as if I mostly cleaned up, but missed a few spots. Claire has a midday press conference to announce all of this. I am officially upgraded from person of interest to suspect, the only suspect. She even says I am probably armed and definitely dangerous. After hours of watching the experts, reporters, and former friends crucify me, I finally leave the house. I drive right out of Hidden Oaks and out into the world where someone may or may not recognize me. Across town, I drive by the Easy Go where I used to get coffee. Instead of stopping, I drive 10 miles down the interstate to another Easy Go, which has the same self-serve machine. With the baseball cap on my head and almost a full week's growth of facial hair, I go in and get myself a coffee. The young guy behind the counter barely looks up from his phone. It is almost anticlimactic. It also emboldens me a little. Every person in the world is not looking for me. I could probably eat in a restaurant, shop at the mall, and see a movie before someone recognizes me. I just don't want to do any of those things. Once I am in Hidden Oaks, something makes me drive by my house. The lawn is clear of toys, and the welcome sign on the door is gone. The shades are drawn, and the curtains are closed. I wonder if Millicent has bought another bottle of eye drops, or if she even looked for the old one. I also wonder if Jenna is the only one she poisoned. I have been sick a few times as well. If Millicent can make her own daughter sick, she is capable of doing it to anyone. But I do not go inside the house. Not yet. I go back to Kokona's. The police are not waiting for me, nor have I been followed. Everything inside looks the same. I almost leave the TV off to take a break, but I can't. Just about everyone is talking about the DNA, and the only exception is Josh. He is back to being a reporter, and he is interviewing a criminal pathologist. This man's voice is not as irritating, but he is a little boring, like a professor, at least until he gets to the paper cuts on Naomi.
The locations of the paper cuts are important to determining what caused them. We say paper because of the type of cut, but there are also different types of paper. For instance, Naomi had shallow paper cuts on tougher skin, like the bottoms of the feet, and deeper cuts in softer areas like the underside of the upper arm. That indicates that the same item was used, but it couldn't have been a regular piece of paper. It had to be something that would cut through the heel of a foot. I jump off the couch like I've been shocked, and in a way, I have. I know what Millicent used to make those cuts.
69. Rarely does Millicent do something by accident. She has a reason for everything, even if it's to amuse herself. This is one of those times. It began so many years ago when she asked me how I would protect her from assholes on planes who try to pick her up. I would force them into the center seat, hog the armrests, and give them paper cuts with the emergency information card. The emergency information card, the one I gave to her on the first Christmas we spent together. She has always kept it. In her old apartment, it was taped to the mirror in her bathroom. Our first place together was the small house, a rental, and the card was stuck to the fridge with a googly-eyed face magnet. When we bought our first house, she slipped it inside the frame of our full-length mirror. And in our bigger, more expensive house, we have two kids who do not appreciate the emergency card joke. They think it's corny. Millicent carries the card with her, stuck inside the visor in her car. When the sun is in her eyes and she flips it down, the card makes her laugh. The card is what she used to make all those paper cuts. I am as sure of this as I have been about anything. Hidden Oaks is not an easy place in which to hide. People notice new cars, especially the ones that just show up and park. They do not notice runners or walkers. People are always starting and stopping exercise programs, so on any given day there could be 10 people out or none. A few are always out, like Millicent, but most come and go. With the same baseball cap, more facial hair, baggy sweatpants, and a big t-shirt, thanks to Kokona, who owns an extraordinary amount of oversized clothing, I leave out the back door of her house, jump the fence, and jog out to the road. It has been only a week since I disappeared, and the press is still everywhere. It would be impossible for Millicent and the kids to live normal lives right now. She can't go to work, and the kids can't go to school. But I want to know if Millicent ever leaves the house. It would be a lot easier to get that emergency card if she takes the car out of the garage and parks it somewhere I can access. Just about anything can go wrong with this idea. Maybe she has thoroughly cleaned that card, so there's no DNA on it at all. Not from her or any of the women. Or maybe she got rid of it, threw it away, or burned it up. For my sake, I hope not. I may not know everything she does or everything she has done, but I know who she is on the inside. She keeps that card to remind her of us and to remind herself of what she did to those women. Millicent enjoys it. I know that now. Will the police believe me if I bring them that card? If it has DNA from one or more of the dead women and from Millicent, but not mine? Probably not. Will they believe me if I also tell them about the building Millicent bought with three LLCs, about Denise and Owen's sister, and if I showed them my schedule when all of these women disappeared? I was always home, and I have no idea what the kids will say about those nights. No, they wouldn't believe me. With my DNA in the basement and multiple people identifying me as Tobias, not to mention Millicent's performance, they won't believe I'm innocent for a second. But they might believe Millicent and I killed those women together, which would keep my children safe. It's the only chance I have, not just to save myself, but to put her where she belongs, in jail or in hell. Either one works for me, as long as it is nowhere near my children. I jog down the block parallel to my house, watching for Millicent's car through the paths between the houses. On my second pass, I jog down the street she would turn on to go toward the school. As expected, I never see her car. Throughout the day, I check back but never see her leave. I just can't be sure. It would be so much easier if I had left the tracker on her car. Still, I try because I have to. Jogging and walking have become my new hobby. Too bad I couldn't adopt that dog at the shelter. It would be handy to have one right now. I call Andy. He sounds surprised to hear from me. Maybe surprised I am alive. I just have a question, I say. Hit me. I ask if Millicent ever leaves the house. I assume she isn't even going to work, I say. He hesitates before answering. I don't think so. Neighbors have been bringing food by every day. It's all over the place. I think they're hunkered down, avoiding the media. That's what I figured. Why? He says. Doesn't matter. Thanks again. You have no idea how much I appreciate this. He clears his throat. What? I say. I have to ask you not to call again. When I say nothing, he keeps talking. It's the DNA. This whole thing has just become so much bigger than I understand. Don't worry about it. I do believe you, he says. I just can't keep, I know. I won't call again. He hangs up. The only surprise is that he stayed by me as long as he did. I didn't deserve his friendship. Not after Trista. The sun has started to set, and I decide to make one last pass by the house before trying to go in. All I have to do is get into the garage, to her car, but it has to be after Millicent is asleep. And I have keys. 15 minutes later, I pass by on the parallel block and look for anything unusual, like an unmarked police car because they are waiting for me to do exactly what I am about to do. Nothing. No unusual cars, no work trucks. There is nothing I don't recognize in the neighborhood. Except me, the bearded guy who jogs too much. It's surprising no one has stopped me yet. I head back to Kokona's using different streets. It's the long way, but I used the short way earlier. By the time I make it to the edge of the circular drive up to her house, I stop dead. A town car is in front. The driver pulls a suitcase out of the trunk. I hear her voice. Kokona is home. 70. She'll know. They will all know. It will take Kokona seconds to realize someone has been staying in her house. The police will know it is me within another few seconds. My car is in the garage. My fingerprints are everywhere. So is my DNA, and Millicent's tablet is right on the kitchen table. Oh, and my wallet. I did not take it with me on the jog. It's also on the kitchen table. I go back the way I came and jog all the way out to the least expensive houses in the Oaks. Here there is a small green space away from the children's park where I stop near a group of trees and pretend to stretch. I've got nowhere to go. No Andy to call or phone to call him with. No money, no friends, and almost a total lack of hope. But I do have keys. They are the only thing in my pocket. Tonight was going to be the night anyway, the night I go into the garage to get the emergency card. In that respect, nothing has changed. What has changed is that I need a place to hide until Millicent is asleep. My first thought is the club. Plenty of small rooms and closets to hang out in until well after dark. Getting in and out is the problem. Too many cameras. The golf course is empty at night, but it's filled with wide-open spaces visible from the road. I'll never find an unlocked car, not in Hidden Oaks. Here, everyone has modern, expensive cars, the kind with computers that do everything, including lock the doors. For a moment, I consider hiding under a car. I'm just afraid someone will get in and start it. In the distance, sirens. They are coming this way, but not to me, to Kokona's. My options are dwindling, and I have to move. I can't just stay in this little green space forever, not unless I bury myself. I even consider hiding in my own backyard. And then, I do. Everything looks different from above. The neighborhood, the cars, the sky. My house, my kitchen, where the light is on. Millicent. She is the one who convinced me to climb a tree. It was not something I thought I would do again, but here I am, hidden within the big oak tree at the back of our yard, far enough from the house that no one heard the leaves rustling as I climbed up it. Millicent is cleaning up in the kitchen. She is too far away for me to see any details other than her red hair and black clothing. I bet she wears black all the time these days, especially when the police come by, mourning those women, her husband, and the breakup of her family. I am both impressed and sickened. Rory walks into the kitchen and goes straight to the refrigerator. He doesn't move his right arm, I assume because the sling is still on it. He grabs something and stays there for a few minutes, talking to Millicent. Jenna never comes into the kitchen, but I have to believe she is okay, not sick. Millicent has no reason to poison her today. My legs start to cramp up and I adjust a little, although there isn't anywhere to go. The kitchen light goes off, but the bedroom lights are on. Still too early for sleep. Around me, the neighborhood goes quiet as everyone settles in. Very few cars are on the road. It's a Tuesday night, not a popular one for big outings. I lean my head back against the tree trunk and wait. By 10 o'clock, everyone should be in bed. At 11, I almost climb down, but then I let another 30 minutes pass. At 11:30, I climb down and walk along the edge of the yard next to the fence, all the way to the house. As I head to the side door into the garage, I look up. Rory's light is out, window closed. We almost never use the side door to the garage. I am exposed a little because it is in front of the backyard gate. I slip the key into the lock and click it open. The noise sounds much louder than it probably is, and I freeze for a second before stepping inside. I stand in the garage next to the door and wait for my eyes to adjust so I don't have to turn on a light. The outline of Millicent's car comes into focus. Her luxury crossover is parked in the center of the garage. No need to make room for me anymore. I walk around to the driver's side, thankful that the window is open. I don't even have to open the door. I just reach up and flip down the visor. Something falls out onto the seat. I feel around, but find no emergency card, nor anything that feels like one. I open the car door. All at once, the light comes on, and I see something lying on the beige leather seat. A blue glass earring. Petra. She knew. Millicent knew about both of the women I slept with. Rory never told Jenna. He told his mother. I fall to my knees. Defeat does not describe it. Done. I am just done. Eventually, I end up lying down on the cement floor, curled into the fetal position. No will to get up, much less run. It's easier to stay here and wait for them to find me. I close my eyes. The ground feels so cool, almost cold, and the air is a combination of dust, oil, and a little exhaust. Not comforting, not pleasant. Still, I do not move. An hour passes, or two. No idea. Maybe it's only been 5 minutes. My kids are what get me up, and what Millicent might do to them. 71. The house is not quite pitch black. Light from street lamps and the moon filters in through the windows, allowing me to see just enough to not trip, to not make any noise. Although I know I will be caught, and soon, it can't happen yet. At the bottom of the steps, I pause to listen. No one upstairs is moving. I go up. The fifth step creaks a little. Maybe I knew that, or maybe I never paid attention. I keep moving. Jenna's room is on the left, followed by Rory's room, and at the end of the hall, the master bedroom. I start with my daughter. She is lying on her side, facing the window, and her breathing is steady, peaceful. Her big white comforter is bunched up around her like she's inside a cloud. I want to touch her, but no, it's a bad idea. I watch, memorizing everything. If they put me in prison forever, this is how I want to remember my little girl. Safe, comfortable, healthy. After several minutes, I leave and close the door behind me. Rory is spread out on his bed, limbs everywhere. Most of them, anyway. The arm he has in a sling is the only one by his side. He sleeps with his mouth open, but does not snore. It's the strangest thing. I watch him the way I watch Jenna, memorizing everything, hoping my little boy turns into a better man than his father, hoping he never meets a woman like Millicent. I cannot blame him for telling his mother everything. I blame myself, for Petra, for taking the earrings, for all of it. I leave his room, close the door without making a sound, and start down the hall. I imagine Millicent in bed, curled up under the covers, her red hair spread out on the white pillow. I can hear the long breaths she takes when she is in a deep sleep, and I can see the shocked look in her eyes when she wakes up and feels my hands around her throat. Because I am going to kill my wife. When Millicent discovered I'd cheated on her, she found her breaking point. Tonight, I found mine. I reach the closed bedroom door and lean close, listening. No sound. When I open the door, the first thing I see is the bed. Empty. My first instinct is to check behind the door, maybe because I know Millicent would stab me in the back. Empty. It's about time. Her voice comes from across the room. I see a shadow, her outline. Millicent is sitting next to the window in the dark, watching for me. I knew you'd come, she says. I step forward, not too far. Is that right? Of course. It's what you do. Come home? You have nowhere else to go. The truth hits like a slap. The worst part is I can hear her smile. It's too dark to see it until she turns on the light and stands up. Millicent is wearing her long cotton nightgown. It's white and swirls around her feet. I was not prepared for her to be awake. I didn't even bring a weapon. But she did. The gun in her hand is at her side, facing down at the floor. She is not pointing it at me. She is also not hiding it. That's your plan? I say, pointing to the gun. To kill me in self-defense? Isn't that what you're here to do? Kill me? I raise both my hands, empty. Not likely. You're lying. Am I? Maybe I just want to talk. She chuckles. You can't be that stupid.
If you were, I wouldn't have married you.
The bed is between us. It's a king size, and I wonder if I can leap over it before she can raise the gun and shoot. Probably not.
Didn't find that emergency card, did you?
She asks. I say nothing.
Rory gave me that cheap little earring, she says. He thought you were cheating, but then realized you were sneaking out to kill women. Of course, I didn't tell him he was right the first time.
I shake my head, trying to understand.
Why? I left that woman alive so everyone would find out what a cheating bastard you are, she says.
Petra. Petra is still alive because she had sex with me, and she'll never even know it.
Do you have any idea, Millicent says, how much therapy our son is going to need?
I cannot comprehend the madness of what she has done, the staggering amount of patience, of discipline. Why not just leave me? I say. Why do all of this?
Do what? Set up our home? Take care of the kids? Make sure everything runs smoothly? Keep track of the finances and cook dinner? Or are you referring to Owen? Because the original plan was to bring him back for us.
She takes a step closer to the bed, but not around it. No.
And you were so willing. I barely had to do anything. You killed Holly, not me.
She threatened you. Threatened our family. Millicent throws her head back and laughs at me. I stare at her, remembering all the stories she told me about Holly, the injuries, the accidents, the threats, the cut on her hand between her thumb and forefinger, the pieces rearrange in my head like a puzzle that had been put together wrong. Millicent had done it all to herself. Holly just got the blame.
Jesus,
I say.
Holly was never a threat, was she? My sister was nothing but a weak, sniveling girl who deserved everything I did to her.
She crashed the car because you were torturing her, I say. Not the other way around. Millicent smiles. Everything hits at once. It's hard enough to make me dizzy. Millicent set her sister up the same way she set me up. She has always tortured people. Her sister, Lindsay, Naomi, Jenna. Maybe she didn't just poison Jenna to keep me out of the way. And me. Maybe all those times I was sick, she had done it. Because Millicent likes to hurt people.
You're a monster, I say. That's funny, because the police say the same thing about you.
The look on her face is triumphant, and for the first time I see how ugly she is. I cannot believe I ever thought she was beautiful. I found the eye drops, I say, the ones in the pantry. Her eyes flash.
You've been poisoning our daughter, I say.
She was not expecting this. She didn't think I would figure it out.
You really are crazy, she says,
a bit less conviction now. I'm right. You've been making her sick all along. She shakes her head. Out of the corner of my eye, something moves. I look toward the door. Jenna. 72. She's standing in the doorway wearing her orange and white pajamas. Her hair is sticking out all over and her eyes are wide. Awake. She is staring at her mother.
You made me sick?
She says. Her voice is so small it makes her sound like a toddler, a heartbroken toddler.
Absolutely not, Millicent says. If anyone poisoned you, it was your father.
Jenna turns to me. Her eyes are filling with tears.
Dad?
Baby, no, it wasn't me.
He's lying, Millicent says. He poisoned you, and he killed those women.
I stare at Millicent, not having any idea who I married. She stares back. I turn to my daughter.
She put eye drops in your food to make you sick.
You're insane, Millicent says.
Think back, I say to Jenna, all those times you were sick. Who cooked your food? How often do I cook at all?
Jenna stares at me, and then her eyes shift to her mother.
Baby, don't listen, Millicent says.
What's going on?
We are all startled by the new voice. Rory. He walks up behind Jenna. His eyes are bleary, and he rubs them while glancing from me to his mother to his sister, looking confused about everything. My kids have seen their own lives implode over the past week. Their father has been accused of being a serial killer. Their mother has likely told them it is true. I do not know if they believe it.
Dad,
he says,
why are you here?
I didn't do what they say, Rory. You have to believe me.
Stop lying,
Millicent says. Jenna looks at her brother.
Dad says Mom made me sick.
She did, I say.
He's lying,
Millicent says.
All he does is lie.
Rory looks at her and says,
did you call the police already?
She shakes her head.
I haven't had a chance. He just walked into the bedroom.
And you just happened to have that gun in your hand? I say. Rory's eyes widen as he sees the gun at Millicent's side. She still has not lifted her hand.
She was waiting for me to show up, I say, so she can kill me and claim I attacked her.
Shut up,
Millicent says.
Mom,
Jenna says,
is that true? Your father came here to kill me.
I shake my head. That's not true. I came here to get both of you away from your mother, I say, and I go even further because they have to know. Your mother set me up. I didn't kill those women.
Wait a minute, Rory says. I don't get...
What is happening?
Jenna yells.
Enough,
Millicent says. Her voice is low and hard. We all shut up, just as we always do when she says that. It is quiet enough to hear everyone breathing.
Kids, Millicent says, get out of here. Go downstairs.
What are you going to do?
Jenna says.
Go. Dad doesn't have a weapon,
Rory says. Again, I raise my empty hands. I don't even have a phone. Rory and Jenna turn to their mother. Millicent glares at me as she steps around them and raises her hand. She points the gun at me.
Mom!
Jenna yells.
Wait!
Rory jumps forward, placing himself between the gun and me. He throws off his sling and holds out both arms. Millicent does not lower her hand. She raises the other one and holds the gun with both hands. The gun is pointed at our son.
Get out of the way,
she says. He shakes his head. Rory, you have to move, I say.
No, put the gun down.
Millicent takes a step forward.
Rory. No!
I can see the anger in her eyes, even on her face. It is turning an unnatural color of red.
Rory,
she says.
Move!
Her voice is a growl. I see Jenna jump a little. Rory does not move. I hold my hand out, intending to grab his arm and pull him out of the way. Right then, Millicent shifts the gun and fires one shot. The bullet goes right into our bed. Jenna screams. Rory freezes. Millicent takes a step toward him. She has lost control. I can see it in her pitch-black eyes. If she has to, she will shoot Rory. She will shoot all of us. I jump forward and knock Rory down, covering his body with mine. Just as we hit the ground, I see a blur of orange and white polka dots and a glint of metal. Jenna, she has the knife from under her bed. I never even saw it in her hand. She heads right for Millicent, the knife raised, and crashes into her. They both tumble backward onto the bed. The gun fires a second time. Another scream. I jump up. Rory is right behind me. He grabs the gun, which has fallen out of Millicent's hand. I grab Jenna and pull her off. The knife comes with her. It slides right out of Millicent. blood. So much blood. Millicent is on the floor now, her hands clasped against her abdomen. The blood is coming from her. Behind me, Jenna is screaming, and I turn to see if she's hurt. Rory shakes his head at me and points to the wall. The second bullet is lodged there, not inside my daughter. Get her out of here, I say. Rory drags Jenna out of the room. She is hysterical and screams all the way down the hall, dropping the bloody knife as she goes. I turn to Millicent. She is lying on the floor, staring up at me. Her white nightgown is turning red right before my eyes. She looks exactly like my wife, and at the same time, nothing like her. She opens her mouth and tries to speak. Blood comes out. Millicent looks at me, her eyes wild. She does not have long. A few minutes, a few seconds, and she knows it. She keeps trying to say something. I grab the knife and bring it down hard, plunging it right into her chest. Millicent does not get the final word. Epilogue. 3 years later. The map on the wall showed the whole world, from Australia to the Americas and the North Pole to the South. We didn't use darts because we all have an aversion to metal objects with sharp edges. Instead, we pulled out an ancient pin-the-tail on the donkey game and put new adhesive on the ribbon tails. Blindfolded, we each took a turn. Jenna went first, followed by Rory. I went last. I breathed a sigh of relief when two of the first three tails landed in Europe. Neither the Arctic nor Antarctica sounded very inviting to me. We tacked up a map of Europe and played again. Wash, rinse, repeat, until we had found a new place to live. Aberdeen, Scotland. Our choice was made. That was 2.5 years ago, right after I was finally cleared by the police. I didn't think I would be. In fact, I thought Millicent would be named another one of my victims. No one knew Jenna stabbed her. Not after I wiped off the knife and made sure the only prints were mine. I also confessed. I told the police I killed my wife in self-defense, because she was the real killer. It never occurred to me that anyone would believe it. And they wouldn't have if it hadn't been for Andy, who said it couldn't be me. I couldn't even use a tablet computer, he told them, so how the hell could I kill so many women without getting caught? Then there was Kokona, who said I was a terrible liar and could never be a serial killer, although she did mention that I was a pretty good tennis coach. And my kids. Jenna told the police that she overheard our argument and that her mother admitted to setting me up. Rory told them it was self-defense because his mother was about to shoot him. Neither told the police what really happened. Those details do not matter. I like to think the police believed everyone who stood up for me, that they knew I couldn't be a killer. But it was the DNA. All the evidence in the church basement underwent rigorous testing at the FBI lab in Quantico. The result confirmed what we already knew. The DNA was mine. The samples came from two sources, sweat and blood. And they saved me. Or rather, Millicent's lack of knowledge saved me. The FBI tests revealed that all the samples of blood and sweat had the exact same amount of chemical decomposition. It looked like Millicent had collected my fluids just once and then sprinkled them around all at the same time. The report stated that I must have been in that basement only once because the DNA had been left on the same day. An impossibility if I had killed those women at different times. It's too bad Millicent never knew how badly she had screwed up. As soon as I was cleared, we sold the house and left Hidden Oaks. The first thing I had to get used to was the cold and the snow. I've never lived where it snows before, but now it surrounds us. At first, it's light and fluffy like hand-spun cotton candy. When it blankets the city, everything goes quiet. It's as if Aberdeen has been lifted right into the clouds. The day after, It's slushy and dirty, and the whole city looks covered in soot. Our third winter is coming up, and I have grown a bit more used to it. Rory has not. Just last night, he showed me a website for a college in Georgia. Too far, I said. We're in Scotland. Everything is far. He had a point, and that was the point, to get far away from our old life. We are doing okay. I can say that without crossing my fingers. Jenna has a new therapist and a couple of prescriptions. I find it amazing that she functions at all, given what Millicent did to her. Rory has his own therapist, as do I. Once in a while, we have a group session, and we haven't hurt one another yet. I do not tell them that I miss her. Sometimes. I miss the family she built, the structure, the way she kept us organized. But not all the time. Now we don't have as many rules, but we still have some. It's all up to me. I can make a rule or not, break it or not. No one is around to tell me if I am wrong or right. Today I am in Edinburgh, a larger city than Aberdeen. I have come to see my tax attorney. Moving out of the country is complicated. Taxes must be paid in multiple places, depending on where money is kept. Our house in Hidden Oaks sold for a good amount. We are more than comfortable for the moment. I also coach tennis. It is a huge sport in Scotland, though much of the time we play on indoor courts. When I am done with the tax lawyer, I find myself with a little time before the next train to Aberdeen. I stop in a pub near the station and motion to the bartender for an ale on tap. He fills a mug with a dark, syrupy liquid, unlike any beer I drank back home. The woman next to me has dark hair and pale skin. She is dressed like someone who just got off work and is having a drink before heading home. I can sense her relief that the day is almost over. After half a drink, she glances up at me and smiles. I return the smile. She looks away and looks back. I take out my phone, type out a message, and slide it across the bar. Hello. My name is Quentin. This is David Pitou. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of My Lovely Wife by Samantha Downing. This program was directed by Scott Sherritt. Executive producer, Diane McKiernan. Text copyright 2019 by Samantha Downing. Production copyright 2019, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this program.